of the part of this unit on the government of the Christian society. Last time we had attempted to spell out how the reform, the medieval reform, begins as a reform of Benedictine monasticism, which is called the Cluniac movement in the first quarter of the 10th century, an attempt to purify the monastic practice within the Benedictine houses, which and also to make the Benedictine houses free of lay control. It was felt that the greater part of the abuses in the Benedictine system were the result of this lay control, lay ownership of the monastic houses. Once the reform was completed within monasticism itself, it spread to the clergy in general, and this is the point of B. In other words, the ideal, what we mean to say here is that the ideal of celibacy in the first place, which is native to the idea of monasticism, but is not necessarily native to the work of a parish priest, it spreads from within the monastic system to the circles outside of it, and also the other ideal of complete separation from the feudal structure of society spreads from the monastery. There are two individuals here that I would like to mention as individuals coming out of the monastery and then influencing the what we would call today, I suppose, the secular clergy, not the monastic, not the monks, but the secular clergy of the medieval Catholic Church. The first name I'd like to mention is that of Humbert, H-U-M-B-E-R-T. Whatever book you're reading, be sure to read a little bit about this individual. He's very important. The book he wrote, which I am concerned with here, is Against the Simoniacs, those who practiced simony, that is, the buying and selling of ecclesiastical offices. This, of course, is a necessary part of the feudal system. When the king or the feudal lord has an area of land on which there is a monastery available, it goes to the highest bidder, and that means that the monastery goes to the highest bidder. And similarly with a parish or with a bishopric, this was called simony. Humbert assumes in this work of his Against the Simoniacs that this had always been considered obviously immoral. This is not the case. It's only in this period now, the 10th century primarily and the centuries following, that this practice is scored as being immoral. Prior to this time, clerical offices, clerical land, ecclesiastical land, had been bought and sold with little difficulty. In this book, Against the Simoniacs, Humbert also talks about celibacy. He demands that all the clergy of the church be celibate. And here again, he scores the clergy where this is not the case, assuming that all of them would recognize that they ought to be celibate, which was, from the documents that we have, at least as far as we can tell today, not the case in the early Middle Ages. There was no recognition then that practices that were known now as simony, or even living with a concubine, was considered perfectly all right for a parish priest in some areas. They felt that in some areas it was felt better for a parish priest to live with a woman without marrying her than to marry her, since this would be against certain canons of the early church. This was, as I say, true only, however, in some areas. The other individual that is very important is St. Peter Damiani, D-A-M-I-A-N-I. This is all under B, the monastic ideal applied to the clergy. He wrote a book called Gomarianus, in which he compared the church of his day to Sodom and Gomorrah. Damiani was an extreme ascetic. He says it would be difficult to find a single priest who was not illiterate, simoniacal, or had a concubine. This is the kind of thing that can be quoted to show that the church in the Middle Ages was all but dead. I think you should note that a quote like this comes from this kind of a tract written to bring about sociological changes within the church. So that simply to quote this sentence as a demonstration of the immoral character of medieval prelates and medieval clergy is hardly proper. In any case, this little book called Gomorrah was one of those tracts coming out of the Cluniac reform, which attempts then to change the attitude of medieval Western European Christianity as a whole. Combined with this Cluniac movement was a revival in the study of canon law. If you are going to apply these principles to the church as a whole, this reformation of the clerical orders on the whole church, then there would have to be some recognized legal basis for it. And this then is the result of the revival in the study of canon law, also coming out of the Cluniac monasteries. The revival of the study of canon law, however, does not emanate merely from the Cluniac system, but it also comes from various centers, intellectual centers in Lorraine or Burgundy, and also from Brittany, as we will see, Beck, Anselm, and Lanfranc, and so forth, after Gregory the Seventh. Canon, of course, canon law, the word canon, as you probably understand by now, is a term that is applied to a number of things in the history of the church. The way if we use it today for lists of books, you see, in the early church it was used primarily for laws that were passed by the councils. These were canons. The first reference that we have to such canons or collections of these canons comes from around the year 400 in the letters of Augustine. The Council of Chalcedon in 451, for example, quotes earlier laws of the church by numbers, which indicates that they had been collected in book form. We don't have those collections anymore, but there is good reason to believe that they existed by this time. The first great collector of these canons was, of course, Dionysius Exiguus. Dionysius, D-I-O-N-Y-S-I-U-S, Exiguus, E-X-I-G-U-U-S. In the 5th century. He collected them in Rome. There's a nice edition of this published out of Berlin, of these works published out of Berlin in 1931, edited by Struwe, if you're interested, S-T-R-E-W-E. These canons, of course, are very important because they form the basis today yet of the whole legal system of the Roman Church, as I'll try to show you presently. So it's this Dionysius Exiguus who attempted to collect these canons for the first time of the early councils, a collection that we still have in great part. But he adds to them, to the canons of the councils, the letters of the bishops of Rome, or the decretals, the decrees of the Roman bishops. So his is a collection of canons and decretals. Now please don't confuse this with the canons and decrees of Trent. There the term canon as well as the term decree is used much differently from the way it is used here. This is often misunderstood in textbooks also. The decrees, of course, that are in Dionysius's work are primarily from Siricius Innocent, the bishops whom we have already studied. Then in the next 100 years, there are evidently other collections of this kind coming from Spain, for example, and from Italy, down to the time of Charlemagne, when he combines many of these collections. This was necessary, because as these canons and decrees were copied generation after generation, they were changed. So that today one of the great efforts of the canonist in the Roman Church is to study the various texts of these canons in order to determine which is actually the ancient canon. Canon 6 of Nicaea is a very good example of this, because this one dealt with the rule or the authority of the Bishop of Rome. And evidently the canon of Nicaea, canon 6 of Nicaea, was not the kind of canon that the Roman bishops and their copyists appreciated by the 9th and the 10th centuries. And so they changed it to translating it, you see, as these processes went on to make it fit. So what Charlemagne does then in his day is to take this collection of Dionysius Exiguus with the various additions that had the various accretions coming especially from Spain, and then he combines this now with the penitentials. So that now you get canons as well as decretals and penitentials that are part of this canonical system. Penitential. Now the penitentials, we'll talk about those next week or the week after next when we talk about medieval theology and the development of the system of penance. But essentially the penitentials were the penance that were assigned to certain sins. In other words, if you did this, this is what you had to have to do for penance. If you did that, that's what you have to do for penance. The relationship of the sin to the penance that was done, as that is spelled out, those are called the penitentials. This was, of course, as we have already indicated in our study of the duties of the bishop, very important, since it was part of the medieval legal system, the legal system of this Christian society. You had to do penance for things like perjury, blasphemy, sacrilege, sorcery, usury. The penance that is assigned to these various crimes are listed in these penitentials. They come originally, evidently, from Ireland. Now, these penitentials, of course, are rather different from the penance system or the penitence system of the early church. By this time, of course, the whole system is in a legal framework. no longer voluntary at all. If you commit a certain crime, you do a certain penance. You see, this was meted out in ecclesiastical court. It is assumed that you are a Christian or a member of the of this Christian society. They are coextensive. The purpose of these penitentials is no longer the cure of souls, as it is clearly in the writings from the early church, but becomes now punishment for what you have done, an ecclesiastical kind of punishment, sort of a legal gospel, I suppose you would say, if that makes any sense at all. Now, after Charlemagne, then, you've got the canons, you've got the decrees, and you've got the penitentials combined now. A very important collection of these things was made in the 9th or 10th century. We don't know the exact date of this collection. And this collection is credited to Isidore. The collection then is called the Pseudo-Isidorean Decretals. The decrees, the pseudo-decretals, the false decretals. That's what we call it today. They are known as the decretals of Isidore. They are accepted as authentic in the Middle Ages, but they are no longer considered authentic by anyone as a whole, certainly not by Isidore. Many of them are. Many of them we can find in other collections, but others of them are also added and are consequently not, generally at least, considered to be authentic. The new items that are added in the 9th and 10th centuries to this collection, this canonical collection, deal primarily with the questions that we have been taking up in here this week. Who actually confers authority on an individual, making him bishop? To whom is the bishop subject? What is the relationship of a monastery to the feudal lord or to a bishop? These are the kinds of things that are added at this time. And evidently the purpose of this collection, the purposes of this collection of Isidore from the 9th and 10th centuries were A, to safeguard ecclesiastical property. In other words, this collection of laws was made in order to show the rights of ecclesiastical property, to protect it from being taken over by non-ecclesiastical forces. Secondly, it was to free the clergy from any secular obligations, feudal obligations, in other words. See, they stress the sovereign power of the papacy. In other words, the clergy have no feudal or secular obligations. The only obligation the clergyman has is obedience to the Roman See. And here, the donation of Constantine is included among these decrees accredited to Isidore. And finally, a bishop is said to be the supreme ecclesiastical authority in his diocese, in his bishopric, or in his area of responsibility. This is evidently a law directed against the archbishop, who is precisely in these years coming into existence as an important power, an important authority in the medieval church. The next step comes in our period then. Well, I guess you can say that the decretals of Isidore are already in our period, but the next step in all of this, important step, is the collection of decretum by Gratian, G-R-A-T-I-A-N, dated in the 1140s. This comes after Gregory the Seventh, the man I want to talk some about a little bit today, but I think we should mention it here because you can see how this thing is just moving along and mushrooming in precisely this period about which we are concerned. The study of these laws, the collection of these laws, becomes very important. Gratian collects a total of 3,458 such ecclesiastical canons, decrees, and penitentials. It was very popular. It was used all over Europe. After Gratian makes this collection, other canons and decrees are added to it in the 12th, the 13th, and the 14th century. These are called the extravagants, the extravagantes, those new ones that wander in. And the canons are also glossed. Gratian becomes the textbook for use in schools where canon law is studied. This, of course, all leads to the great collection of canon law, the Corpus Juris Canonici, in 1503. That collection which Luther had. You see, by this time, of course, elements from non-Western European codes, such as Justinian's Code, play a very important role, have a very deep influence on this. And this same collection, the Corpus Juris Canonici, was revised as recently as 1917 and is used today in Roman Catholic seminaries under the title Codex Juris Canonici. One of the interesting things coming out of Vatican II is the suggestion that we need another revision of these collections of canon law. Now, this material, the study of this material is revived concurrently in connection with the revival of a sincere kind of Benedictine monasticism under the name Cluny, and especially with the effort to free both monastery and priest and bishop from any feudal control. They appeal to these canons, these papal decrees, where the king of Saxony, for example, Otto, or the king of England, the successors of the Normans in this period, might appeal to precedent, to common law, to immediate precedent. The canonists will say, but we appeal to the older, the Catholic, the more authentic precedents of the past. Unfortunately, some at least of these canons to which they appealed were not authentic. One of the most important instances of this is, of course, the donation of Constantine, which they all at this time assume to be authentic, and plays a very important role then in the efforts of priest, bishop, and papacy to assert claims in the life of, in the political structure, rather, of this Christian society. Now, one of the most important individuals in this area, a student of canon law, was Hildebrandt or Gregory the Seventh. Perhaps one of the most important bishops of the Roman Church, one of the most important popes. He stands in a straight line, 1073, with Innocent the Third at the end of the 12th century, at the end of the 1100s, and then Boniface the Eighth in the period immediately before the Reformation, immediately before the Avignon Papacy and the Great Schism. These three popes are very important. We should spend some time talking about them tomorrow. What we don't say today, we hope to say tomorrow. Gregory the Seventh, Innocent the Third, and Boniface the Eighth. If we don't get to this in the discussions tomorrow, please be sure to study the work of these men in some textbook. They're the most important bishops, most important popes in the Middle Ages. The work of Gregory, first of all, Gregory the Seventh, who is for our purposes here, for introductory purposes, the most important, because he's the one that sets the pace for what the other two contribute to. This material is presented, first of all, I suppose the classic work on Gregory up to this point is the work by Fliche, F-L-I-C-H-E, The Reforms of Gregory, or the Gregorian Reforms, 1924. That deals specifically with Gregory. However, there are two other books that I think I would recommend for you. Fliche is in three volumes, and it all deals with Gregory. There are books that are broader in their scope, and for that reason would perhaps be more interesting to you, dealing with the same subject. The first one is by Gerd Tellenbach, T-E-L-L-E-N-B-A-C-H. This is concise, the kind of thing you can read in a couple of evenings. Church, State, and Christian Society is the title of the book, translated into English in 1940 by Bennett. Another book of similar value is the much larger work by Walter Ullmann, U-L-L-M-A-N-N, The Growth of Papal Government in the Middle Ages, published in 1955. These last two have a broader scope, and for this reason I think would be of greater value for you at the present time, to see just exactly what the Great Reformation was all about in the Middle Ages. Now, as I said, this Hildebrandt, the man who becomes Gregory the Seventh, Pope Gregory the Seventh, the most important thing, it seems to me, that we have to know about his early life, the period before he becomes Pope, is that he was a student of canon law. This was his frame of reference. This was the cast of his mind. If he had any assumptions in making ecclesiastical political decisions, if he had any assumptions in dealing with the various princes of Europe, these assumptions were from his study of canon law. He was educated as a child in a Cluniac monastery, which I think is very interesting, that he was a Cluniac, or that he received all of his ideas from the Cluniac tradition, is not quite true. But certainly he's raised there. There's a great debate about whether he ever does become a monk, take the vow. There's good evidence on both sides of this question. Then he studied under Wazo, W-A-Z-O, in the school at Liège. This is in Lorraine, the Lorraine School of Canonical Studies, as it's sometimes called. And then later, he continues this study. One of his close friends was a canonist from this period named John Gratian, who later becomes Pope Gregory VI, after his childhood friendship with Hildebrandt. He becomes Gregory VI, and Hildebrandt then in turn becomes Gregory VII. This canonist, then, this student of law, becomes Bishop of Rome in 1073 by the leave of the German emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor at this time, Henry III, in whose court Hildebrandt spent a great deal of time, and then Henry III's successor, Henry IV, with whom Gregory comes into conflict. Now, in order to understand Gregory, I think it's important to see that it was precisely during this period that the German emperors, Henry III specifically, and then Henry IV, took a great deal of interest in who was Pope in Rome. This interest has a very positive influence on what goes on there. If you've been doing any reading at all, and have read about this period prior to the middle of the 11th century, the period of pornocracy, or at least so-called pornocracy, in Rome, you can understand why the German emperors felt it was necessary to intervene and to use their force, their authority, in naming individuals to the See of Rome who were reliable, who were truly interested in the furthering of something beyond their own family possessions, their own relatives, you see, which was quite often the case during this period. But once this happens, in other words, instead of the Bishop of Rome being elected by Lombardian tribes, Lombardian dukes, Lombardian nobles, that is Italian, the Italian nobility, once it is the authority north of Italy in Germany, what we know today as modern Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, that is doing this, a reaction sets in. Coming out of this Cluniac movement, and prior to the ascendance of Gregory VII, to free the papacy, the Bishop of Rome, from any imperial control. In other words, these individuals, like Gregory VII, one of his predecessors, Leo IX, a very important bishop in this particular problem, they were concerned to reform the papacy. And they were willing to utilize the authority of the Holy Roman Emperor in this area, of Henry III or Henry IV. But they were not willing to allow that the Bishop of Rome should be elected north of the Alps by secular forces in the Holy Roman Empire. This puts them on the horns of a dilemma, obviously. You either take both or you take none. They wanted the good without the bad. And this made things very difficult, both for Leo IX and for Gregory VII. Now, in order to bring this about, in order to free the church, the election of the Bishop of Rome from imperial interference, they reserved the election of the Bishop of Rome to a college of clergymen in the area of Rome. And this then is the beginning of what we know today as the College of Cardinals. In other words, they had to find some kind of an authority to name a successor. They didn't want that authority to be the Lombardian dukes. They didn't want that authority to be the nobility, much less the emperor in Germany or in the north. And so they chose to set up this chose to utilize this thing that was already in existence. It has been in existence since the early church. You have the famous seven churches in Rome, and the clergymen, the bishops of these churches, formed a sort of collegium. That out of that now comes this College of Cardinals, the important bishops in Christendom, and to them is given the responsibility of electing a new pope. The very famous, important document here is the document of the election decree of 1059, which you have in Bettinson on pages 142 and 3. Be sure to read that carefully, because there it is suggested that cardinal bishops elect from the cardinal bishops a new pope, so that if, as long as this decree is followed — it wasn't always followed after it was made, but when it is followed — it's impossible for the German emperor to interfere in the election of the Roman bishop, and it is also impossible to elect a layman to that office, as was often done in the 200 or so years prior to this election decree. The cardinal bishops shall confer. Then the fourth point, that lest the disease of venality creep in by any means, godly men, the sunnier pars, shall take the chief part in the election of the pontiff. This was one of the great loopholes in all of medieval democracy. They were really never willing to allow for a majority vote. It was always the same majority. Sometimes it was felt the majority is the ignorant or the insane part of the vote, and consequently ought not to be followed. This loophole is unfortunate, because it negates at least some of the value of the decree, because it always allows the nobility, either the Italian or the German nobility, later on the French nobility at Avignon, to suggest that the bishop whom the cardinals elected was elected by the insane majority, and consequently is not to be followed. And then they would name another one, because whenever the College of Cardinals could not agree on an individual, then it was proper, but only then was it proper for the imperial authority to intervene. Now, this election decree of 1059 is strengthened in succeeding councils in Rome after Gregory the Seventh. These councils are often classified with the ecumenical councils, the first five or the first seven, depending on how you number them, from the early church up to the eighth century. The so-called Lateran councils, or the Lateran synods of Rome, held in 1123, for example, another one in 1139. These dates are not so very important. Then the Third Lateran in 1179. The importance of the Lateran Council of 1123 is that it eliminates this loophole about the same majority and suggests that a mere majority in the College of Cardinals can elect a new bishop. And the importance of Third Lateran in 1079 for our purposes is that it is no longer a mere majority, but a two-thirds majority that must be had to elect a bishop. This, of course, is far necessary. The rules for electing a bishop of Rome today, as you know, are most confusing to someone who is not part of the machinery. But it was most necessary, these changes were necessary in this 12th century especially, in order to bring some kind of unity, that you finally get a man around whom all will unite, rather than someone who will divide the church. You find a consensus, rather than someone in the extreme. One of the finest studies of this whole question was done by Marcel Pacote in his biography of Pope Alexander III, P-A-C-A-U-T, Pacote. Now, so that what happens here immediately before the election of Gregory VII is extremely important, because during his own pontificate and then the pontificates of his successors, this change, this effort to limit the authority to elect a new bishop of Rome to the College of Cardinals, this effort is strengthened and furthered in a succeeding council. The most important, I suppose, of all of these Lateran councils is that of 1215 under Innocent III. We'll talk about that Lateran council in connection with the suppression of heresy in the Middle Ages, because that's what it is known for primarily, although it also is engaged in the question of who names what makes an individual bishop of Rome. So that when Gregory VII, or when Hildebrand is named to be bishop, he is named by this clergy in Rome, and is then confirmed by the German emperor. In other words, he merely he agrees to this. This is not necessary to the election actually, but it would be very difficult for a bishop to serve in Rome without yet having schism on his hands, and that often happened in the period prior to Gregory VII, and will happen again, as you know, many times in the history of the Roman Church, where you have two and three individuals who claim to be the Bishop of Rome. In order to avoid this, you get the confirmation of an authority that is able to enforce the decision. Gregory VII got this. But then Henry IV, who confirmed him and protected him, although he had done nothing particularly to merit it up at this point, felt that Gregory VII should in turn declare hold a coronation, you see, and officially declare him to be emperor of the Romans, just as it had been done a number of times in the past. Gregory was not willing to do this. Gregory was not willing to do this unless Henry IV agreed to clear up the ambiguity that had existed in the whole relationship between papacy and empire from the time of Charlemagne and even before, by agreeing to the fact that the ultimate authority in Christian society is the Bishop of Rome, and even the Holy Roman Emperor though he may be, is subject to the Bishop of Rome. the correspondence of Gregory, the so-called register, the collection of his letters, indicates very clearly that Gregory the Seventh at least seems to believe this quite sincerely, that being made the Bishop of Rome, he is really the ruler of Western Europe, the ruler of Christian society. And the Holy Roman Emperor should be no more, actually, than his protector, his advocate. In his letters to the Normans in England, in his letters to the King of France, in his letters to the Danes, in his letters to the Slavs, all of these materials indicate the same thing. This cast of mind of Gregory the Seventh that he inherits from his study of the canon law, which, very importantly, includes the donation of Constantine. And this is the basis, of course, on which he can make this claim. When Gregory will not agree to this, the only thing that Henry will not agree to this, the only thing that Gregory can ultimately do is depose him. He accuses him of a number of crimes, spiritual crimes. These accusations are probably in great part true. He accuses Henry of simony. He accuses Henry of certain immoralities in his youth, for which Henry had long ago repented and had been absolved, and then deposes him. Now, this had never been done before, and there is no explicit authority in canon law for this either. But it is possible to read canon law in such a way to make this possible. And that's, of course, what Gregory the Seventh was doing. It was necessary, then, for the imperial authority in Germany, the successors of Henry the Fourth, to have their own canonists, who then resurrect the study of ancient civil law. Not the corpus juris canonici, but the corpus juris civilis. The collections of Theodosius II and of Justinian, in order to oppose the authority that comes from God directly to the ruler, divine right, against the legal authority that was claimed by the Bishop of Rome. One more point. Be sure to take a look at the Dictata Papae, the dictates of the Pope, that should be P-A-P-A-E, Gregory's famous encyclical, his famous pronouncement, in which he claims that all of this is true of him, that he is the ruler of all of Europe, can depose any king, and is infallible. It's a very important document. It is not in Bettinson, curiously enough. I don't know how to explain that, but it's not in there.